Okay, we will continue with the conceptual framework. We will first have two presentations from the two Andrews, beginning with Andrew Watchman.
Thank you, Hans. So, agenda paper 4A, measurement and the conceptual framework. I should point out, first of all, this is an EFRAG secretariat paper, not a formal EFRAG position. It hasn't been approved as such by the EFRAG board. The objective of this paper is really to continue EFRAG's efforts to point the way in which we think the measurement guidance in the conceptual framework could be enhanced. We prepared this paper before having seen the staff redraft the measurement chapter, so interesting to compare the similarities and differences in the respective directions of travel between those papers, and indeed before seeing the ASBJ's paper, which covers some very similar territory. It's also a follow-up to a paper we brought to the ASAF back at the April 2016 meeting, which really tried to expand EFRAG's thinking on how the business model could or should influence the selection of a measurement basis. This paper assiduously and deliberately avoids the words business model as far as possible because it seems to have different meanings to different people and to some extent serves only to curtail the discussion, whereas the objective of our paper today is hopefully to generate some discussion. So when we responded to the conceptual framework exposure draft, we welcomed the guidance in the exposure draft as far as it went, in particular the acknowledgement that a mixed measurement model was going to be the way forward, an acknowledgement, I think, that measurement bases should be selected from both a statement of financial position and a statement of profit and loss and other comprehensive income performance reporting perspective. And as far as it went, we welcomed the recognition that the way in which an asset or liability contributes to cash flows would be one of the relevant factors, along with the characteristics of the liability or asset in question. But overall, we felt that guidance ought to be enriched, doesn't go far enough to provide genuinely helpful and meaningful guidance for the IASB board to take properly informed decisions on measurement bases going forward. So that's the objective. I guess the particular positions of EFRAG within that have informed the details of this paper, we would like to make sure that it is, in terms of the relative importance of financial performance and financial position, that's not just lip service, that actually the detailed contents of the measurement chapter properly acknowledge the different ways in which measurement bases influence performance and position and provide balanced guidance on whether and how such information would be relevant. And that, we believe, often means you might actually point in a different direction from a balance sheet informed position, in which case perhaps some compromise ought to be sought. And if no compromise can be found on a suitable compromise, you might choose different measurement bases and use OCI as the bridge, so to speak, although we've tried to kind of follow the rules and not stray too much into OCI and performance reporting in our discussion on measurement bases, but that can be a challenge at certain points. So I won't go through the details of the paper in too much depth, but if I jump onto paragraph 12, page 3, we started out focusing on assets. We could in due course expand the discussion into liabilities as well, but we feel that just distinguishing assets based on how they contribute to cash flows is good as far as it goes, but actually assets play different roles in business operations. They can contribute to cash flows in different ways. So even with the ED makes a distinction between contribute to cash flows on a standalone basis or in combination with other assets. We don't think that really goes far enough. Even looking at contributing to cash flows standalone, that could be contributing primarily through sale or contributing through periodic returns, and indeed what IFRS 9 distinguishes between those two scenarios. An asset might be used primarily for risk management purposes, in which case its measurement basis might be influenced by that context in which it's held to achieve an appropriate to appropriately report the risk management activity that is taking place. So 12A is trying to categorise assets in a slightly more granular fashion, because we feel that these distinctions can actually help inform the selection of a measurement basis. Coming back to this theme about performance reporting, and this is paragraph 12B, a key question should be whether and when value changes should be reported in the statement of financial performance. And I think especially when discussion moves into current value measurements, I think sometimes some of the discussion in the past about how that is relevant to financial performance can be a bit thin and could benefit from being enhanced. We do recognise this point about a compromise, that's paragraph 13. In other words, if you're getting different pointers from a position and performance perspective, can you find a reasonable compromise? And if not, then we don't, as a general matter, object to having different measurement bases for the two purposes. We then move on to try and sort of test this. And we thought about what type of asset to test our thinking against. And it might seem rather esoteric or obscure, but we came up with a racehorse, mainly because we wanted a type of asset that might not be explicitly covered by existing standards, in order to perhaps not prejudge the discussion based on existing requirements. So we came up with a racehorse, which in terms of how that's used in the business, it's going to be used to hopefully generate prize money, etc., from being used for racing purposes. And there's a small prospect that it might become hugely valuable and be sold off to stud, but that's a small prospect. And going through our factors for this particular fact pattern, we concluded that probably historical cost was the appropriate measurement basis, but we recognised that you could tweak the fact pattern only slightly and maybe get to a different conclusion. So that was our thinking. I'd welcome any comments, suggestions, reactions from ASAP members.
Could I just ask one clarifying question? When you talk about reaching a compromise in terms of the measurement basis, what exactly do you mean by that? Do you mean sort of plumping for one measurement basis or another, or do you mean in some way tailoring the measurement basis to try and get attributes of, say, both historical cost and current value somehow? It wasn't clear exactly what you meant by the compromise point.
Sure. I think more the former. We tried to limit it at this stage between a current value and a historical cost type measurement. And I guess if you concluded that maybe in the balance sheet a current value is slightly more relevant, slightly preferred, and maybe for financial performance historical cost was more strongly preferred, then the compromise might point to historical cost overall. But if there are clear pointers in different directions, and we're not in any way trying to say that you're going to get a sort of objective algorithm that leads automatically to these conclusions, there's going to be a lot of judgment involved at the standards level. But we think probably wouldn't want a proliferation of multiple measurement bases, so we'd look for a compromise where a possible compromise can be found.
Thank you.
Thank you, Hans. We support the general direction of the FLAG paper, especially the observation in the paragraph 3, which states the reporting of performance is inextricably linked with the measurement basis used. As a specific comment, in particular on paragraph 13, we have a slightly different view. We think there is no need to seek a compromise when the measurement basis that best reflects financial performance differs from the measurement basis that best reflects financial position. If the two measurement bases differ, we think OCI should be used as a linkage factor. Another comment is paragraph 12b seems to imply that short-term changes in value should be recognized in profit or loss when the asset is disposed of, and long-term changes in value should be recognized in profit or loss in each period. We think the factor to consider is irreversibility and not whether the changes are short term or long term.
Sorry, Yuka, what was the last thing you said? It should reflect?
Whether they're reversible versus short term or long term.
Yeah.
Okay. Mary?
Andrew, you were talking about enhancing the discussion of how considering the statement of financial performance as well as the statement of financial position. I'm not sure if you saw in the redraft that was provided for context. There's a paragraph, I think 46.49A, that's talking about bringing into the measurement chapter the suggestion that the process for selecting a measurement basis is to start with identification of the phenomenon and then say what's the most relevant information about that. So it doesn't say financial position or financial performance first. It says phenomenon and relevance of information about that phenomenon. And I wondered if you thought that the consideration that you gave to build out the statement of financial performance considerations would fit in under relevance, or if you think you'd say, no, let's redraw the flow chart of sequencing.
We'll talk about the staff redraft later on, but when I saw this articulation, it would start with the most relevant attribute, go with that one, and then see if it can be faithfully represented. And the answer is yes, you're kind of done.
Yeah.
I think from an FRAG point of view, we'd see that possibly as two parallel flowcharts from a performance and a position point of view, and if they come out at the same answer.
Okay, so in essence, that would be the considerations that you'd make to determine what is relevant.
Yes, but we might have made, I would say, independently or in parallel, but certainly on an equal footing between performance and position. So you could think about, I guess, as two parallel flowcharts. And like I say, if they pop out with the same answer at the bottom, that's great, you're done. But if you're coming out with different conclusions, then you've got to consider the compromise point. But
I was trying to get that those two approaches are not incompatible. You're just, from your perspective, building out how you would assess relevance. And you're making the point that you have to consider, in your view, in parallel, financial position and financial performance.
Yes, that's a fair summary.
Andrew, my question relates to paragraph 11D, or 12D, about assessment of stewardship. As a request of our constituency, we try to emphasize more stewardship in the chapter one. But historically, in the conceptual framework, also in the standard setting, I'm not sure whether we once mentioned for this purpose specifically. And my question to you is, you highlight here separately. My question to you is, from your point of view, whether you feel the performance of the entity and that of its management are different or are the same for standard setting purpose. If you feel they are different, can you give us an example?
Yeah, FRAG is a strong advocate of the consideration of stewardship standard setting decisions. We also acknowledge that the term can mean different things to different people and doesn't seem to readily translate into certain languages, but the concept we have in mind, and I think this came through with the research we conducted on how professional users use financial information that I mentioned this morning, is exactly that distinction, the performance, the overall performance of the entity versus the overall performance of management. And one might argue, I'm not saying this is my particular view or position, that in looking at the performance of the entity, somehow a current value measure is always going to be more relevant. One might take that position. From a perspective of how well have management performed, you might want to distinguish between those things that management is affected or is responsible for from those things that are outside management's control. And not everyone buys that distinction, I fully realise that, but our own investigations with users suggest people are trying to draw that kind of distinction. How do I hold management to account? Are they doing a good job? And there are some things they can be expected to have more influence over than others. I think it's easier from a financial performance point of view when you've just got to decide based on what management are trying to accomplish, and I'm in danger of using the business model phrase here, what they are in business to do. Should a value change be recognised, for example, at the point that an asset is sold, because that's actually really what this entity is trying to do, add value in some way, provide goods or services and sell them, versus whether or not they are primarily there to try and outguess the market.
Now, when we develop we use got four, you know, benchmark.
Yeah.
You know, within or outside the control of members is one of them. Now, if you follow that road, can I give you one example? Whether you feel we should account for differently impairment. There is high probable, you know, some of the impairment is not under management control. Should we account for them differently?
Can I think about that one? I don't think we're questioning the need for impairment when assets are stated above their recoverable amounts, and some of these things would need to be dealt with, or this distinction of what caused the impairment. I think that's an existing disclosure in IS 36, if I remember well. A user might need to make their own judgments about whether that's a factor for which management is ultimately is responsible, or some stuff that's happened beyond their control.
Chris?
So I guess just picking up on that thing, that was what I was sort of taking away, was that there seemed to be this still, I guess, confusion about what we were trying to actually represent. Was it actually a stewardship performance perspective or a contribution to the future cash flows? And I think if we're not very clear, and if we're actually trying to do both, then it becomes very difficult to work out what those factors are. And I guess even though you haven't used the word business model, there's still a fairly strong flavour of this is written from the perspective of what management thinks about what they're going to be doing. And so my concern is if we hardwire that into the conceptual framework without really understanding all the implications, then we're going to end up with something that's going to be quite difficult to get around in the future. And I think one of the things I think we need to do is we need to step back and actually have a think about, from a user's perspective, what is their main concern with the current information they get, and why is there all this concern about fair value? And I sometimes think if we ask them, if you take out of the equation the fact that you don't trust management and you don't believe their assumptions and you don't really have any faith in the current fair value methodologies, if you put that to one side and said, okay, we actually think that we do have some good information here, what would you choose? Would you choose historical costs? Would you choose fair value? Would you still choose something in the middle? And that's where I think we need to get to, is what's the real underlying drivers of why people feel concerned about some of those fair value issues. Some of it's costs, because obviously you just at this point in time we can't come up with those numbers on a cost-effective way. But again, if we hardwire something into our conceptual framework that doesn't look forward and say that all of these things might actually improve in the future, then I think we will have locked ourselves into something that's not helpful. So whilst there's some interesting discussion and some useful things to draw out, we'd be suggesting at this point keep the conceptual framework pure, for want of a better word, and then bring a lot of these factors in as part of your standard setting process so that you can react as and when circumstances change.
Maybe just one comment also on that stewardship in support of Andrew. I think that if we feel so concerned by stewardship, it is also because it is one of the criteria of the IS regulation in Europe, so to assess the stewardship. So, and in addition, I think that it, as Andrew already mentioned, it is in order to have a kind of continuity between the management and its measurement of performance and the way it is presented in the financial statements. Just a comment on your question about impairment. Maybe the impairment may be outside of the control of the management, but the value put in the goodwill or in the assets at the origin before the impairment result from management's decision and a kind of promise of future cash flows and stewardship may be assessed also as in such a situation, in my view.
Rebecca.
Thank you, Hans. I guess from our perspective, we would also support seeing that the framework give guidance on how to select a measurement base, but I guess similar to Chris, to maybe express it a little differently, some of the proposals in your paragraph 12 start to say how it would happen, and it creates a starting point that it seems we would have to then work to refute that. So that would be kind of Chris's acknowledgement of something being hardwired. When it really, there are multiple factors that we really need to consider, and when relevance is that first one to be identified, that is considering what is going to be that useful information, what's the value, the measurement base of when it provides information about that item, the change in it, or that's the what is relevant. So we were a bit surprised by the reference in your paragraph 11, without contacting users, how would we know what information they would need? And I have to say, at the World Standard Setters Forum, having gone through the testing of the assets and liability definitions, I start to look at some of the proposals in 12 and looking at how using the management approach or what the intended use is to say, should we go through also a similar testing process if that would be part of the framework? Mm-hmm. Because there are many different facets, which I think we'll maybe talk to when we talk about the IS staff draft of the measurement chapter. But there is a lot to be considered. It's a complex decision. So if you had any insights or feedback from the users you considered, be interested to know, because I think we need to really ask that and learn from that. But as well, on your example of the horse, you make the comment that historical cost would provide stewardship information. Could you describe what that stewardship information would be, how that would help them assess?
On the racehorse, the idea we're getting at is starting with what is management. If you're an investor in this business, you're investing in a strategy, business plan, if you will. What is management setting out to do, and how? What information then is best, is most useful for assessing how successfully or unsuccessfully they've been executing that plan, that strategy? So if their plan, in the case of the racehorse, is actually basically to try and successfully engage these animals in racing and generate prize money, then that will be, or information on how well they are doing that would be the most relevant from a stewardship perspective. And it so happens that in this particular line of business, every now and again a horse will turn out to be very successful and very valuable, but suggesting, again, from a stewardship perspective and probably from an overall financial performance perspective, is better to sort of recognize that when it actually happens and the horse is sold off, rather than try and estimate fair value in a more general sense, or in an overall way, when the predominant business practice will not be to actually sell the horse at all. Not sure how clear that is, but
But isn't the information that you want to assess is whether it's the right decision to hold it or get rid of it?
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a dog...
Donkey!
Slow. If it's slow.
It's slow. Still running. So that's where I think it's quite difficult to say that performance shouldn't be measured as you go and that you wait till the end, because particularly with some of those types of assets, it's actually probably better to find out earlier on rather than than just continue. And does it really come back to Wagyu's question that you're concerned about the control, that you can't control the price, but I mean, all the fair value movements, and there's a whole lot of things that you can actually do as management to manage that whole process.
Even in terms of forecasting future cash flows, how relevant is the fair value of an asset that on the balance of probability you're not going to sell?
It's still fair value is telling you your expectation of what your future cash flows actually are. So it must have, and the fact that you don't expect to sell doesn't mean that you won't, because surely that's the decision of management, that if and when it gets to the point that there's a higher and better use of doing something else, you need to know what that tipping point is. If you're so focused on historical cost.
I feel we're getting drawn into sort of most likely outcome versus probability weighted average type thinking in this scenario. And each individual horse is unlikely, quite remote in this business, to be sold. But looking at the business as a whole, then every now and again one will be sold. But I fully agree, it's complex, and there's no intention to create a kind of cookbook here that will bind the board too strongly into future decisions, just to provide a richer discussion from which to draw.
Jean.
The AOSSC working group members generally agree with the IFREX proposal. There is one comment which is related to the example used in this paper. The one member commented that the example is not appropriate to assess whether the proposal of IFREX are operational. The example shows, as you can see the paper, racehorses contribution to cash flow consists of two parts. Part A is prize money less related expenses. And part B is potential sale to stud. The uncertainty of the part B might include uncertainty of sale and the measurement uncertainty. The IFREC selected the historical cost as a measurement basis because relevance is limited and the faithful representation is questionable if they choose current value due to the uncertainty of part B. However, that member noted that two cash flows, part A and part T, are not independent. It's rather part B is a dependent variable of part A. In other words, if racehorse goes on to win the race and the prize money, and the uncertainty of sale will be reduced and the selling price of the racehorse will be increased. Therefore, it is controversial that IFREC selected historical cost based on merely the uncertainty of cash flow part B. Furthermore, in applying the same example, one may draw a different conclusion. That is selecting current value depending on its estimation of the degree of uncertainty. Consequently, if we need to develop more suitable example, that is the.
Doesn't our biological bear assets put this standard, put this horse into fair value?
I don't think it's a bear asset.
You're not keeping it for biological reasons.
I believe it's a broodmare, but I don't get too technical.
We're like cows and everything. I think so, no.
It's not in scope.
No? No. Scope?
Not in this country, anyway.
But what do our stats say for cows, for example?
I think it's animals that are subject to biological transformation, and I think the assumption you had was that it was a fully grown horse, so there's no biological transformation.
I don't think it's agricultural to subject that.
But perhaps if you're involved in breeding the horses, then that would be.
Okay. The semen could be another issue.
ASAF is always educational, huh?
It's very short here to just tell you that a few people got into this example here and end up with absolutely different conclusions applying the criteria. So they actually like the criteria, so very good. So they concluded that fair value, this is a good case for fair value. And one of these guys is actually a raw horse, I don't know how to
trainer?
Trainer or something like that. I say, how do you do it? So, in my mental accounting, I have a fair value for that, because if somebody makes me an offer, I obviously gonna sell. So, and they normally sell in between points in time. So I know that I'm not helping, but it was very confusing. The people got very different conclusions, the same example with the same criteria. So that's a very good case of fair value. I said, no, there's a very good case of historical cost.
I agree with Alexander. I guess that the average horse owner, who are not average people, but the average horse owner thinks of his horses in terms of fair value and not historical.
Yeah, you know the person Brazil, and I asked him, how do you do that? Well, I do accounting only for tax purposes, but my mental accounting is fair value, so I feel happier in terms of fair value, not historical.
This concept of mental accounting needs further development, I think.
Rebecca?
I just wanted to make one observation, because in the example, you do refer to taking depreciation. So if you were following, for example, the property, plant, and equipment standard, you would then also have to consider either the residual value from sale or its salvage value. So you would have to be doing that estimate anyways to do historical cost. That's part of the challenges and its complexity.
Mm.
So just a
fair point.
Okay. Let's move to.
Thank you, Hans. Yes, perhaps I should say, to avoid confusion, that anybody that's been meeting with me earlier this week, I was wearing an FRC hat. This afternoon, I'm wearing an ISB hat. I think the EFRAG paper provides a very helpful introduction, because they were certainly not alone in their observations on the exposure draft, essentially to the effect that the measurement chapter had quite a lot in it that they agreed with. They agreed with the use of different measurement bases for different assets and liabilities, and they agreed broadly with the measurement bases that were set out, and even some of the factors to consider were strongly supported. But there was a feeling, which EFRAG state and which others also did, that the chapter didn't provide enough guidance to the board to see how it could be used in helping to develop future accounting standards. We've been reflecting very heavily on those comments. Some people who expressed that view suggested that perhaps the thing to do would be to reconsider the timetable for the whole framework, or take the measurement chapter off the table and then undertake some fundamental research, which might take some time, and then add in a measurement chapter subsequently. The board rejected that approach. The board would like to issue a revised conceptual framework that does include a chapter on measurement, but recognises the need to improve what was said in the exposure draft. So we've been thinking about how we might do that, and in particular we've been focusing on the factors to consider, wondering if we can perhaps try and not describe them more fully and more precisely, but in particular to say, well, and after you've considered this factor, in what direction would that tend to push you? A couple of points to make on the redraft, which appears in paper 4C. I would stress that it's very much a working draft. It will change not only as a result of your comments, but for other things as well. We considered whether one way of giving more direction would be to list the factors in some kind of rigid hierarchy or suggest a prescriptive order. We've concluded that wouldn't work, and indeed we've retained the thought that was in the exposure draft, that it will all depend on the facts and circumstances. In fact, we've given that even slightly more emphasis. We've also retained the thought that you've got to consider both the statement of financial performance and the statement of financial position, and try to get the message across that that should be even-handed. I think we may hear when we consider the ASBJ paper whether that's the right way to go. And perhaps in the light of the discussion we've just had, it's helpful to point out that the exposure draft measurement chapter also included a discussion of dual measurement, where you might use a different basis in the in the statement of profit and loss from that used in the statement of financial position, with differences going to OCI. That bit of the exposure draft chapter is not in the redraft that you have, which is not intended to signal that it would be that there's any intention to delete it. The board hasn't come to re-deliberate on that specifically, but I think it's quite likely that it will be substantially changed. So just because it's not there doesn't mean it won't be, so perhaps we could bear that in mind. The board discussed this at an educational session earlier on this month. That was an educational session deliberately because we wanted to take to the board in a decision-making session something that reflects the what we hear this afternoon. But I did promise an oral update as to how the discussion went. I think it's fair to say that most board members thought that this was heading in the right direction. That is to say, it's getting better rather than worse, which is reassuring. Very strong feeling that it's a bit too long, perhaps a bit too discursive. It might stray into some areas that are more appropriately dealt with in standard setting rather than in the concepts. And a lot of comments on specific paragraphs, and I won't attempt to. I have got a list of them, but I'm not going to go through that list now because it wouldn't really serve any useful purpose. So with that, I'll just say that I'm very much looking forward to your views, comments and suggestions as to how we can improve this before we take it back to the board for a decision-making session.
Thank you. We are disappointed that the section on situations when more than one measurement basis provide relevant information was not included in the redrafted paper. The paragraph 6.76 of the exposure draft had acknowledged that there could be two measurement bases used. That is one for the statement of the financial position and another to determine the related income or expenses in the statement of profit or loss. The table 6.1 on the agenda paper 4C seems to assume that there is always a single measurement basis that best reflects financial position of the item and the best to determine the profit or loss. However, we do not think that that is always the case. For example, in the past, IAS 39 had an available for sales category where the fair value was used for the statement of financial position. But historical cost was used for the determination of profit or loss. The same can be said for the FVOCI debt instrument under IFRS 9. Our question is whether the ISB intended to carry over the proposal in the section on situations when more than one measurement basis provides the relevant information from the exposure draft, or whether the ISB intended to make any changes. If the ISB is making any changes, we'd like to know the direction of the changes that will be made.
Well, if I could just respond to that. We haven't yet re-deliberated that section of the measurement chapter, so we haven't made any decisions on that. And one reason for that is that we needed to make decisions on P&L and OCI in advance, and that's something we're going to be discussing later in this section. I think, broadly speaking, we will be retaining the discussion of dual measurement, and perhaps I made a mistake in not including that in the redraft, and I'm sorry if that gave a misleading impression.
Andrew?
Thank you. Well, I think our general FRAG views have really been covered in the previous paper, but I have a few specific reactions to the staff draft here. I agree it's certainly a substantial step forward, so we're very grateful to have the chance to see this. Regarding the two-step iterative process, you know, step the most relevant and then see if it's representationally faithful, I think I've commented on the fact that you might need to sort of do that twice from a performance and position perspective. A related point, I've never been quite clear whether representational faithfulness is a spectrum or a threshold. And I think the way it's been articulated over the years, it sometimes reads much more like it's a threshold that it's almost impossible not to be able to get across, because given enough disclosure, any measurement can be representationally faithful. Now, Andrew, you and I have had this discussion before in another context, and you made the point that maybe that concern has been somewhat mitigated by more recent amendments, but I think it's only been somewhat mitigated. And especially now the discussion about measurement uncertainty has been incorporated into the concept of representational faithfulness rather than into the concept of relevance. Yeah, there must surely be a spectrum, because there's a spectrum of measurement uncertainty, there must surely be a spectrum of representational faithfulness, which will probably add to the complexity of actually selecting a measurement basis based on this guidance. But I think that's what Jim Leisner might call good complexity. I certainly would object to the idea that if representational faithfulness is going to be a key criterion to select a measurement basis, it has to be meaningful and therefore can't be something that you can always meet, a test you can always meet with enough disclosure. It becomes a nullity if it's seen in that way. I think I commented earlier, I felt the discussion on, from a financial performance point of view, the discussion on fair value was a bit thin. There's more sort of justification for using historical costs from a performance perspective than there is on the fair value side of things. And I think the best illustration of that is in the is paragraph 629, where rather than directly explaining how or when fair value is relevant from a performance perspective, it goes straight into how you might disaggregate fair value movements to give them predictive or confirmatory value. Well, disaggregation has got its place, but sort of the starting point is to say when and how is the fair value movement in total actually relevant. This is very much straying into financial performance and disaggregation. The table on 6.1 under historical cost, I think one point to make about historical cost when it comes to assets and liabilities with contractually specified cash flows, so I guess I mean financial assets and liabilities in practice, is that historical cost or amortized cost does actually take account of expected cash flows. Basically, it's the discount rates that doesn't change to reflect market conditions, but expected cash flows are taken into account in that measurement. So I think that is going to be relevant, indeed is relevant in IFRS 9 in making the selection of measurement basis, kind of a detailed point. We're getting there. On measurement uncertainty, now part of representational faithfulness, but I'm not quite sure if the drafting's entirely caught up with that in some places, but I think I've made that point before. But overall, very much moving in the right direction.
Thank you, Andrew.
Cédric?
Thank you. We have focused mainly on the relevance part, paragraph 6.54. we appreciate that there is a link between the measurement and the different kind of reason which may lead to a certain measurement. That was one of the expectations we addressed in the discussion last year on the conceptual framework, so we really appreciate that contribution, mainly for the first part with regard to the country to the way an asset or a liability may contribute to future cash flows. It is in line with the IFRAG document, and it is well balanced on the two views. With regard to characteristic of the assets or liabilities, we are wondering whether there is such an imbalance, because we have a slight perception that it goes rather in the direction of a current value measurement. I would just take one example. In the paragraph 6.54H, let's take the example of a bond which would be with a variable interest rate, for example. We would come in the situation where the asset is subject to variability of cash flows. So it would be current value, then rather. Let's say now that the bond would be with fixed interest rate. We would come once again the same category, because the value would be sensitive to market factors. So in both situations, we would land in a current measurement, whereas to date it is possible to have an historical cost in that area. So maybe it would be interesting to develop, elaborate the argumentation behind the conclusion which is expressed in that paragraph.
Thank you, Secretary.
GM. AUSG working group members generally agree with the proposal. There are two minor comments. One member commented that the paragraph 6.54b state the most relevant measurement basis for asset producing cash flows trajectory is fair value or value in use. And paragraph 6.54c describes the cost-based measurement basis is likely to be more relevant for asset producing cash flow in trajectory. However, some existing standards such as IAS 16 and IAS 40 permit an entity to choose between the cost model or fair value model. Therefore, the effect of the proposal on existing standards should be discussed. the second comment is another member commented that the ISB needed to consider the possibility of a conflict between the two factors in selecting measurement basis and how it should be resolved in such cases. Okay.
Rebecca?
Thank you. I guess given the views that we've expressed before, I'm going to position my comments from the perspective we recognize the board wants to move forward in finalizing the framework, including a chapter on measurement. And I guess from listening to the comments shared here, it seems when we read the words, we each have our own starting point. So I guess the advice is here is to be cautious, because while we very much support the staff's approach in the sense of being balanced as to how you would approach historical cost versus current value and how complex the decision is as to what measurement base one would be selected, then that there should be many factors to consider. I guess the concern we had in reading this is that when it's positioned that historical cost, you've expanded as to how it can be complex to determine. As I mentioned earlier, it doesn't recognize that for you recognize note amortization in the description, but not that you would have to also consider that residual or salvage value, which is a current value. Yet when, so it describes the attributes of historical costs, but then for current value, it talks about some of the, I think the disadvantages of what that basis would be, yet there aren't disadvantages described for historical cost. So with that spirit of neutrality, I guess I'd encourage you to look through that again. But to move it forward, I guess we would recommend focusing on giving a framework of how the board would think through and just, you know, what were the factors it would need to decide on what a measurement base would be rather than giving direction. So of particular concern is the paragraphs in 54B and C. While we agree you would need to assess relevance and then faithful representation, when you start to look and assessing that relevance and how it contributes to future cash flows, there's statements here that the most relevant basis is likely to be. That's going to set the bar of which, well, how do I refute that? Rather than saying, what is the most relevant information and why? So I'm just wondering, because I agree that we should be looking to assessing that future cash flow, is it enough to note it in the framework and explain why it could be relevant, rather than it is the most and likely? Because the other factors, such as looking at the characteristics of that asset liability and the risks, those are other ones that you've said should be considered equally, but when you start off at the beginning with such a strong statement, that doesn't enable that more fulsome consideration. And just to bring in that user view, I think would be, as to making the assessment on relevance, I think would be very helpful.
Andreas.
Just to follow up from Rebecca's comments, which I agree with, we have been quite concerned that two important bits in the measurement chapter we believe to be missing. One was, which are the factors that the board will take into consideration when setting a measurement attribute? And the second one was, how would you weigh the different attributes, especially in cases where you get conflicting signals? So the first one we sort of see addressed, subject to Rebecca's point that you probably shouldn't be as definitive in the conceptual framework, but rather have a discussion of the factor. But the second one, I think, is still missing, and I would like to see it really. So what do you do if you run through the different factors and you get 3 in favor and 5 against? Do you just count the factors? Would you say one trumps the other? And why is that? So is there an embedded hierarchy in this? And this would be, I think, important to make the chapter really a useful tool for the board, to say what's the decision-making process that then follows from the factors and assessing the factors.
So I would certainly echo the comments of both Rebecca and Andreas. On the other hand, I would say, Andrew, that this is a substantial step forward, so I certainly would agree that it's heading in the right direction. The concerns that we have are, again, around those factors mostly. There's what I would call a lot of unstated implicit assumptions that you've made to get to those outcomes in those factors, and I think if you can step back and just say, okay, if we're looking at it from a user perspective, how did we actually get to this point? And again, I think some of those are based on where we're at today. So we do need to make sure we haven't actually covered, cut off opportunities in the future. So whilst I would also agree that this has somewhat more balanced discussion of the different factors, I still think that there is a little bit of a balance more towards historical cost. So I think the way that the current value, current cost piece has been set out, so good to see it's actually in the right location now. just the way that's set out, it comes across very negatively. And I think there are some positive attributes to doing current cost. And so I think if you're going to
do it. It just needs to be that they're all set out in the same way, so it doesn't presume that you're giving one over the other. Just one other factor that hasn't sort of really come out before. In this chapter, we have a couple of examples that talk about no exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just like to caution the board about using that term in the conceptual framework. So I think it's an historical term. It's come from in the past. We've sort of had this notion that if you didn't get something back that was of equal return to you, then this was a no exchange or a non-reciprocal type transaction. In Australia, we spent a lot of time thinking about this, and we found that this distinction is really not very helpful. And if SASB went down this route and put it into their conceptual framework, and they've actually now found that it's causing them a lot of trouble. So what I would say is that there are no real exchanges that are no exchange. Everything has some sort of value back to you, but it's often difficult to work out what that value is. So if I give you a grant and I give you $100, I still implicitly think I'm getting something back to me that's worth $100. It's not something we would necessarily put in a balance sheet or anything else, but there is some value, obviously, because I could have given you 120 or I could have given you 80, but I chose 100. So I would strongly caution you against putting something in again that may cause you problems down the track.
Thank you, Chris.
Stephen?
A question for Andreas. What did you have in mind? So you mentioned about the weighting of factors and there needs to be more. What exactly do you have in mind?
The thought process that you as board members would apply when you have to make a judgment as to the measurement attributes. So you now list the factors, but it is a listing. But it doesn't say, what do I do with this listing? How do I digest that? How do I use it in coming to a view as to the most appropriate measurement attribute?
Isn't that going to be specific to the topic we're covering? How could we, you're thinking of some sort of flow chart or hierarchy or this is most important. Can you give an example of a situation where such a flow chart would help?
No, I wouldn't think in terms of flow charts because that would say, well, would suggest there is a hierarchy, and I was just making putting that forward as an example whether there is or is not a hierarchy. The question that I merely have is, what is it that the board would then do if the measurement chapter stays as it currently is? You would see all the factors, you would probably run a certain case that you have to decide on through these factors, and what do you do if you now get conflicting messages? You would have to apply some sort of reasoning, judgment, whatever. Would you just say you flip the coin, or would you say you go for those that have the most hits, or
would you still just acceptable to EFRAG?
Could we have that in writing, please? I don't have a solution here for you. But if I were in your shoes and I was being told this is the future chapter that would tell you as board members how to select the measurement base, and I would say, well, I still do not really know what to do because I see a lot of description, but I don't really see much that helps me in my decision-making process. You may see it differently, but this is how I read it. So I wonder whether there is a step that is probably missing in between the final judgment that you have to make when setting standards and the description of the factors that is needed. Whether you say, well, this is the freedom that we need in order to make sensible accounting standard setting, that may well be, but then probably another paragraph saying exactly that would be helpful, I believe.
I think we do need that freedom at a standards level. I wouldn't be in favour of including more than we have at the moment.
Well, it will be highly difficult to do.
Which is why I asked the question of exactly, do you have any suggestions?
No, I don't have any firm opinion as to what I would like to see there. But I was wondering whether there is not a step that is missing. And I was really coming from the cohesiveness point of the standards. So if you just have this layout and you say, well, we decide on a standard by standard basis which measurement attribute we want, how could you then really say that the standards have any cohesive link to each other? Or would you really go on a standalone basis and deciding each accounting standard topic? It may be an answer, but I'm not sure whether it really catches the cross-cutting effects that solving this particular accounting question may have on other accounting questions.
But isn't the problem you don't have a capital maintenance objective? So until you actually have that, you can't actually do this chapter properly.
That's probably true.
So if you, so whilst I agree with you, I think it would be highly dangerous to do what you want to do.
Okay.
We go.
Exactly what asked, similar question as Steve asked. No, you didn't give examples. I give you two examples.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you can give us advice, you know, make us easily make decision. The two assets have the current value aspect, but also cost or amortized cost aspects. You may say not enough. Then what kind of, you know, the criteria or thought process do you give us? One asset is PPE, the taxi driver's car, and you know, have cost aspect, used for long-term purpose, combined with other assets. But the car price change quite dramatically, particularly new car or the used car, and then you know the debt asset, you know, we call the third category in line, and the current position is OCI for the debt because they're two purpose. And normally the car will be carried at cost. What kind of, you know, advice will give us? You know, make it easier to make decision these two kind of assets for many basis.
I would probably revert you to what Chris has just said. It requires an overarching objective as to what is it that you want to achieve, and then you could probably follow a decision-making process. But I think there are good arguments for either. But I think if you run through the example, if you run through the individual characteristics, I think you could probably tick the boxes and lay out arguments in favor and against of each of them. But then the question is, okay, so here I am, here I have the list, here I have the discussion, what's next? What do I do?
Well, we seek your advice.
The advice was there was a good case for both arguments. So.
That's exactly what we think as well, and that's why we continue as planned.
Okay,
Alexander.
I got a specific point here on the measurement uncertainty. And especially there is a word in here that's caused some concern. It's that in some case the level is paragraph 6.58a, which is in some case the level of measurement uncertainty is so high that a different measurement basis may provide the more relevant information. The problem is this can work as an excuse because think about measurement uncertainty is not well defined. Well, it's defined that it's not outcome uncertainty. That, I believe that's quite clear in the paper. But I believe it's if I was thinking about investments in non-listed companies,
sure,
we are supposed to be carried at fair value.
Yeah.
Say, well, but I do not have a market, etc. It's very hard to estimate. I don't have betas. Cannot do a. So let's go to historical cost for that because. And I believe for certain assets, when it's related to the business model of company, investment company that have those assets to sell in the future, they should never be allowed to use historical cost in that sense, because obviously they are doing that for fair value appreciation. But this is my point. I believe it's coherent with the paper, and people can use that to.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
This is not for the preparers, this is for the standard setters. Let's not forget this. I mean,
Mary?
Just going back to Andreas's comment and, you know, Stephen Wegwo's, I share their concerns about having something that's too prescriptive in the conceptual framework, because it almost feels like you're saying it isn't really a selection determination by the board. It is, here are the factors and see what output the conceptual framework generates for you. It's almost like an algorithm trying to be put in here. But I take your point about what do you do with these factors, and what came to my mind is saying that if these are the factors, would presumably it would not just be helpful, but you would expect to see in the basis for a conclusion of a standard a discussion of how the board considered those factors in making its selection of a measurement basis, so that rather than putting something in here about thou shalt do this with X, mm-hmm. saying these are what we'd expect to see discussed to support the board's decision, that kind of thing.
Steve?
Just to Alessandro's point, that paragraph doesn't say you go from fair value to cost. It simply says that fair value may not provide the best information in cases where measurement is highly uncertain. Of course, in the example that you give, cost also probably doesn't provide very good information. And it does then acknowledge that in some situations it may not be appropriate to recognize the actual liability entirely. So it's not just about fair value versus cost.
I understand it perfectly, and I personally are happy. I'm happy with that, but I believe that can be used as an alternative. I believe it should be explicitly say that measurement uncertainty
is considered by the board when it makes a decision about the requirement of standards.
Because as you mentioned, this conceptual framework is intended to the standard setters, of course, but preparers would look at it too, obviously.
That's what may be concerned about your statement, that preparers might look at it and say, we don't have to use fair value for these unlisted.
Yeah, but I believe if it's not your intention to have the interpretation that I did, I believe this should be clear.
It is clear at the standards level. That's what IFRS 9 says. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then I think we have discussed this sufficiently, and we move on to Yulia, right?
Yep.
Talk about other comprehensive income.
Mm. Thank you, Hans. So I'm going to walk you through key tentative decisions made by the board on reporting financial performance and the reasons for those decisions. But I would like to start with just a little bit of a background and a few reminders. So in March, the board discussed the feedback on reporting financial performance. That feedback was largely mixed, although there was a fair amount of support for profit or loss as a primary source of information about financial performance, and also support for recycling. In April, we discussed that feedback with the ASAP, and we sought your advice on finalizing the guidance on reporting financial performance in the conceptual framework. Later in April, the board discussed the approach to finalizing the guidance in the conceptual framework and decided that the conceptual framework should provide high-level guidance on reporting financial performance, and that guidance should be based on the proposals in the exposure draft, amended as necessary in the light of feedback received. And in making that decision, the board considered the advice provided by yourselves and also the advice provided by advisory council. In June, the board discussed reporting financial performance and decided to confirm many of the ideas included in the exposure draft, but also decided to make some particular changes to those ideas. Specifically, the board noted that many respondents agreed with the idea of profit or loss being the primary source of information about financial performance for the period. Accordingly, the board decided to reaffirm that description. However, the board decided not to include in the conceptual framework the discussion of the purpose of profit or loss. The board noted that the proposed discussion of the purpose was largely reiterating the overall objective of general purpose financial reporting, and therefore was redundant. And in addition, the board also noted that the exposure draft did not propose to describe objectives of any other statements. The board also confirmed the idea of profit or loss being the default location for income and expenses. However, the board agreed with those respondents who argued that rebuttable presumption is not an appropriate mechanism for the conceptual framework, and therefore decided to replace the proposed rebuttable presumption with a general principle. The board also agreed with those respondents who argued that in deciding whether income and expenses should be included, should be excluded from profit or loss, the board should not only consider the relevance of information, profit or loss, but also faithful representation. So as a result, the conceptual framework will state that income and expenses are excluded from profit or loss if that will enhance relevance or faithful representation of information in profit or loss, which is only expected to occur in exceptional circumstances. The board also noted that most respondents did not object to the idea that only changes in current values of assets and liabilities can be included in OCI. Certainly, there was no appetite in the feedback for including income and expenses measured at historical cost in other comprehensive income, so the board decided to reaffirm those proposals. The board also noted that most respondents agreed that all or some income and expenses included in OCI should be recycled, and noted that recycling is consistent with the idea of primacy of profit or loss, so accordingly the board decided to reaffirm that proposal. However, consistent with the changes made to the use of profit or loss, the board decided to replace rebuttable presumption on recycling with a principle, and also decided to include in that principle a reference to faithful representation. So as a result, the conceptual framework will state that income and expenses included in OCI are recycled when doing so would enhance relevance or faithful representation of information in profit or loss. And finally, the board noted that some respondents were unclear whether only the board can make decisions on the use of OCI and recycling, or whether preparers could also make some such decisions. And therefore, the board decided to clarify in the conceptual framework that only the board, in making standards, can make decisions on the use of OCI and recycling, and that in making those decisions, the board would need to explain why the use of OCI and recycling would enhance relevance or faithful representation of information and profit or loss. So these are sort of the main tentative decisions made by the board, and I'm very happy to take your questions.
Andrew?
Yeah, just a couple of questions on where the board ended up. So does the reference to rare circumstances survive? And I'll just before you answer, in the absence of a definition of a profit or loss or OCI, if the objective of using OCI is to enhance the relevance or faithful representation of profit or loss, then rare circumstances could be a descriptor of how often you think that is possible. It's only in rare circumstances that this will be the outcome, or it could be saying despite the ability to enhance the relevance or faithful representation of profit or loss, we're only going to do it rarely. I don't know which direction this reference to rare circumstances is pulling in. That's my first question.
Okay, so let me try to answer that. I think there are a couple sort of elements to your question. So first of all, the board always intended in the exposure draft itself and also in the tentative decision that profit or loss is the default location. Mm. And when we had this rebuttable presumption in the exposure draft to begin with, again, it was sort of to emphasize this idea that P&L is the main place where income and expenses go, and only in sort of rare circumstances we would use other comprehensive income. However, in the exposure draft, this reference to rare circumstances was not explicit, rather it was implicit in the rebuttable presumption. And so because the rebuttable presumption was replaced by the principle to emphasize the rareness of use of OCI, the board decided to make this explicit reference. Mm. Does this answer your question, Andrea? So in other words, I think it's fair to say that the board thinks that it will be rare that including income and expense in OCI would enhance relevance or faithful representation in profit or loss.
Well, I guess my take would be, if profit or loss can be improved, whatever that means, but just go with me, can be improved by using OCI, then why hold back? Why restrict yourself? And if you think it's only rarely that profit or loss could be improved, potentially, that could be expressed in a slightly clearer way. But you can limit the ability of the board to improve profit or loss, would be my suggestion. Again, whatever that means. My second question was the reference to current measurements. You can use OCI in rare circumstances for excluding a change in the current value. Would that or could that include something like a long-term liability under IAS 37, the effect of a change in the discount rate? Would that be or are you talking solely about fair value measurements here?
Well, I think there are maybe two, again, elements to your question. So we're not talking just about fair value, we are talking about current value deliberately.
Mm.
And then I think the question of whether a particular change in current value would qualify for the treatment would be standards level decision, not the conceptual framework decision.
That's clear. Thank you.
Thanks, Hans. Well, actually just picking up on Andrew's comment, and I guess it ties back to the discussion we had just now on the measurement. That in a way, this wording here about in the rare circumstances almost already concludes that you wouldn't have a different measurement basis that's relevant for statement of financial position and performance. Because I guess again, if we did, well, you've got to find a place for the remeasurement if it's not relevant to the statement of financial performance. So in a way, I think this conclusion is almost saying, going back to the measurement, well, you can actually only have one measurement basis. In other words, it will be extremely rare to have two relevant measurement bases, you know, one for statement of financial position and one for performance. Because if you did have that, you've got to then find a place to put the remeasurement.
And I think it is the second one, and I agree that would be an implication if we're saying that the use of OCI is rare. The implication is that the circumstances where we have different measurement bases in the statement of financial position and profit or loss, those circumstances would be rare as well.
And I don't know, so going back to the discussion we had, you know, just now, I mean, is that the conclusion there that it would be rare that you did have that?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think it was also part of the exposure class discussion.
I think it was, yes. Yeah. But we'd have to
in the measurement chapter.
Yeah.
And John?
Thank you. Just one question with regard to the to the criteria of the non-recycling, because on the current the decision made by the board. If there is no clear basis for identifying the period in which recycling should occur, then the OCI should not be recycled. I'm not clearly understanding what's the meaning of no clear basis of identifying the period in which recycling should occur. For example, if the company has a non-trading equity investment. According to current IFRS 9, the changes of the fair value of those non-trading equity instrument investments will go to OCI. And maybe several years later, the company sell the equity instrument investment, and the period is. The sale date is there, so the which period belong to the which period belong to is clear. So whether it should be could be recycled or not, I'm not sure. Yeah, because it can be clearly identified which period it belong to.
So I think the important element here is that the exposure draft does not, the tentative decisions do not say that. You will only not recycle if there is no clear basis for either the period or amount to be recycled. According to both, actually, the exposure draft and the tentative decisions, the absence of such a clear basis is one example when the board might decide not to recycle, but it's not the only example.
But isn't that example that's not clear? Because the build-up of the value has occurred over a number of periods, so to lump it back in just in one period just because you happen to sell it wouldn't seem to be the right answer either.
On the issue of the equity investments, I think the reason why you're putting the fair value gain or loss into OCI in the first place is because you're arguing that fair value gain or loss isn't somehow relevant to the profit or loss. And if you make that argument, then it's difficult to see why the subsequent recycling of that gain or loss is actually relevant when you ultimately come to sell it. It comes from the sort of the basic idea that sort of underpins the fair value OCI for equities, which was the idea that it was in some way a strategic investment, and so the fair value fluctuations weren't relevant. So with a strategic investment, the idea is that you don't actually ever sell it. In the rare circumstances when you sell it, why does the accumulated fair value gain and loss suddenly become relevant?
Well, haven't you realised that at that point? I mean, isn't there, again, there going to be an argument both ways, I suppose, to say, well, I now sold it, and so now I actually realised all of that, and so, yes, over the years it may not have been relevant to my performance, but
well,
now it is.
So you've held it for 25 years, the price has multiplied by 20 times, you make a huge profit in the last year when you sell it, it has never been held for value change, and then you would recognize a huge profit in the last year, but it has been accumulated very gradually over 20 years, and you have always said it's not, it doesn't say anything about my performance. It doesn't make sense.
But then we do the same thing for property, plants, and equipment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perhaps that's wrong too, I don't know.
what you're saying by this approach is it no longer becomes relevant for the performance statement because you've remeasured it on the balance sheet. Because to Kim's point, PP&E, that you're not remeasuring the balance sheet, you're saying it would be relevant to the performance statement when you're selling it, but if you're remeasuring it on the performance or on the balance sheet,
then it's not relevant.
Yeah. And I think what you're really saying is it's not relevant to the performance statement because you have depicted it in another performance statement. That's why you're saying recycling is not relevant, because you've already done it and you're just treating comprehensive income as a second performance statement.
Mm. It is also just a fantastic opportunity for income income management, earnings management, which is a little bit more difficult with PP&E. Can still be done, but that's not the purpose why people have PPE.
No.
And the available for sale cutting category was hugely popular for earnings management purposes.
So what does that example actually do for your principle that you should only put it into OCI if you think it's going to be recycled? Because it's a couple of examples.
I don't think we say that.
We don't. No, that particular sentence is gone actually. It was part of
what is the principle again? The principle.
So
the
principle is if you put it in OCI, it should probably be here recycled, but there can be exceptions.
Mm. And we are saying that, for example, it may not be recycled if there is no clear basis for the period or for the amount to be recycled.
In the absence of a definition of profit loss in OCI, when will a basis ever be put? It's going to be a rather arbitrary distinction or decision. I would point out a lot of the income and expenses we report in a particular period does result from things that happened in a previous period for lots of different reasons.
Mm.
Support of Kim's point.
Well, but your own paper that you just discussed now, it said clearly it would be nonsensical to recognize a value change that has been that has occurred over a long period in one particular period. That's what your own paper said then.
I don't read my own paper that way, but I'll have to consult some of the authors.
Mm.
Just going back to your basis for the recycling, I think what will probably give you a clue for the clear basis for recycling is the reason why you put it into OCI in the first place. So, for example, if you look at the concept of a dual measurement, in order to get your dual measurement to work, so in order to be able to depict historical cost, for example, in the statement of profit or loss, you have to do recycling because historical cost ends up with a gain or loss and disposal. The only way you can get the gain or loss and disposal is actually to do the recycling. And so I think looking at the reason why you put it in OCI in the first place will give you the basis on which to do the recycling in a lot of cases. In other cases, it might not be clear, and in that case, we say we wouldn't recycle.
Alberto?
I would go back, like Andrew, to this paragraph 4C. Again, I mean, I'm not convinced by the explanation of the phrase circumstances, because looking at what is in the other comprehensive income now, I don't think it's rare circumstances, but anyway. The other point is that you said here, if I read it correctly, because English is not my mother tongue, that you would post, the board would decide to post in other comprehensive income, change in current value of an asset or a liability, if and when the board thinks that this would be more relevant. Seems to me that you are restricting what goes to OCIs to changes in current value of an asset or liability. But might not be the case always. I mean, we have the cumulative translation adjustment already there, which is not a change in current value, it's just a mismatching for translating foreign balance sheet accumulated over the years. It's not current value. I don't think we want to limit to that. I mean, to changes in current value.
Does the staff agree with this?
Do you want, if I respond, yeah, on that one? Is Alberto, I agree that limit to disaggregation of current value measurement would be inconsistent with some things that currently are recognized in OCI today. I think, though, you know, in remembering some of the encouragement of the conceptual framework to be aspirational and a framework for future decisions rather than trying to rationalize, you know, backfill all the decisions that have been made before. You know, we tried really hard, especially in developing the DP and then moving from the DP to the ED, to say, can we come up with a more explicit description of what is the role of OCI and when, you know, when do you recognize something in OCI? And ultimately concluded that we weren't going to be able to, and we weren't going to be able to define P&L either, but that we wanted to tighten up on the use of OCI so that it wasn't always a neutral, do we do this or do we do that, but start with a very strong presumption of recognition in P&L, and really limit the cases in which we would use OCI. And I think this description of only if it's a disaggregation of current value is a limit that would be more restrictive than we have been to date. But as we keep saying about conceptual framework, it doesn't override existing standards, and we would not automatically go back and, you know, and reverse them. So it was an attempt, it was indeed an attempt to limit it from what it is today, but you're right, it is inconsistent with some of the things.
And then another point, the following point, point D, in making such a decision, the board would need to explain why excluding the change. Why do you want to oblige yourself every time to a detailed explanation of why you have excluded the problem? I mean,
I think it's the same thing about, I think it's the same thing about more discipline, and are you really sure you want to push it into OCI? I mean, it's raised, you know, there was a deliberate decision to raise the hurdle for the use of OCI.
To limit it.
Not put it out of bounds, but say, are you really, really sure?
Yeah, we're discussing it now in the FICE project. We're discussing extending the use of OCI. And then the question
if we do so, does that enhance the relevance of the performance statement is really important.
But still have rare circumstances.
Sorry?
Still rare circumstances.
Yeah.
That's maybe maybe the part you want
it
to...
It will remain rather exceptional. Ray Guo?
Your question is valid. But my explanation, whether you agree or valid or not, your issue raised by Tucker for many times when we developed the conceptual framework, EP or ED. But I think both not intend to include or not include such OCI into the current idea or not. The board decision is we have such short tight schedule. We not intend to tackle current issues within this project. And this was board my understanding. So Tucker raised many times about the current translations, and the capital maintenance and the measurements. What are the relationship among them? I think my understanding is, what the idea is, we have such a short, tight plan. It's not appropriate to put this into consideration.
I appreciate what Mary said. And this is aspirational, and in the individual standard, we may override the conceptual framework, because you have the freedom to do that as well.
Yukio.
Thank you. We have a couple of observations on the ISB's tentative decision made in June and July. That's why we developed our paper 4E, but that will be later explained. But here, I just like to give just one comment. The ISB's tentative decision to set out a principle that income and expenses should be included in the statement of profit could mean that items that are currently included in OCI should be included in profit or loss. We are concerned that this tentative decision is likely to change the substance of profit or loss without defining the financial performance or profit or loss. The board tentatively decided to remove the description of the purpose of statement of profit or loss. As a result, we believe that the criteria regarding profit or loss would no longer exist and there would be no foundation to determine profit or loss.
Okay. Then I think, Yukio, the word remains yours.
Okay, thank you. I'm assuming ASAF members have read our paper 4E, so I'll not repeat the details. In summary, our view is that measurement basis for the statement of financial position and the measurement basis for determination of profit or loss should be determined independently. The former would give rise to comprehensive income, and the latter would give rise to profit or loss, and any difference between the two would be the OCI. In order to keep profit or loss the primary source of information about an entity's financial performance for the period as it is today, we think conceptual framework should, at minimum, describe the fundamental characteristic that profit or loss should possess. If profit or loss were to be useful, the measurement basis for the determination of profit or loss should be selected so that it would possess these fundamental characteristics. We are of the view that conceptual framework should clearly state the linkage between profit or loss and measurement. Discussion points are provided in the page 9 of our paper, but we welcome any comment or feedback on our paper.
Cédric?
we found the document of ASPG very interesting because it clearly states the articulation between the measurement in financial position and measurement in the P&L with the OCI. Whereas it also raised the question of the relevance of having such a difference, especially in of having current value in the financial position, which is what may be the aim of having current value in the financial position, especially in a case where the OCI would not be recycled at the end. We have launched in France at the ANC a study. We have asked some academics to work on OCI. We have not the final version of that study, but we have some preliminary information on the role of the OCI as assessed by the users. What seems to be very interesting is that users are more in favor of a normal, usual net result than a comprehensive income that is not followed up in itself. But what is interesting is that they do find an interest in the OCI, not as a measure in itself, but in its volatility, in assessing the risk of the company and the exposure of the net result to a specific market risk, such as interest rate or exchange rate. So, and that is then an additional information of the risk assessment of the company. And therefore, we will investigate further in that direction and hope to provide you with more information in the future.
I looked cursorily at that academic study. It contained, again, a lot of the usual prejudices about IFRS and ISB. Perhaps, you know, that our default measurement was the fair value, stuff like that. It was, I thought, oh my God, I thought we had rebutted those arguments so many times already. So perhaps you can take a look at that. Any other comments? Andrew?
Well, thank you for the paper. And I think there's a lot of common ground between this paper and the FRAG paper. Looking at your second discussion points, the argument starts by looking at useful information from a profit and loss account perspective. As I said earlier, I think we'd be more inclined to put performance and position on an equal footing. And perhaps it's a fact of being based in Belgium, but we'd be more inclined to actually seek a compromise if we've got different directions. But I think we're talking about a small nuance, a shift of emphasis. I think ultimately if profit or loss can be enhanced by use of OCI, then that should be the decision. Thank you for the paper.
Any other? Yes, Chris?
Just to echo that, we would struggle with saying that statement of financial performance should have primacy over statement of financial position. We think they will need to be working together. But it's becoming clearer and clearer that people have different perspectives about what's in the statement of financial performance. And I think that the operating profit project that's going on is probably the way to be starting to think about it more than perhaps putting something in the conceptual framework that's going to lock us into something that will be a problem down the track.
Okay.